It was called Iggaville 2000. Well, there are a number of characters in this story, so I think it might be a good start to introduce the characters to you first. Tony's introduced me briefly, and yeah, I was at CAT from 1988 to 1998, originally trained as an architect, and pretty well the first thing I did after I qualified as an architect was help set up a housing association in Bristol with a few other architect friends, which ran itself as a cooperative, and it was specifically just buying up existing housing and renovating it and renting it out to people that for one reason or other slipped through the rungs of the housing ladder. So I mean, it seems amazing looking back on it now. This was in the early 70s, but nobody else would house single parents at the time. Local authorities wouldn't house them, most housing associations wouldn't house them, so we housed them. We housed a lot of ex-offenders, people with various problems that meant that the normal housing providers wouldn't deal with them. Yeah, so then I went off on a sort of rather strange route. The problem basically was that I got hooked onto the whole environmental cause while I was still a student of architecture, and this was back, you know, in the late 60s. And there were absolutely no opportunities for an architect that had environmental leanings then. So basically I've had to spend my entire life sort of walking around the outskirts of the profession. So after the Housing Association episode, I did a bit of teaching and research. I spent some time in Somerset, which is why I'm spending this weekend going around looking at some of the places I used to live in. And one of them was actually a very interesting big estate called Ammerdown, which is just on the outskirts of Radstock. It's on the sort of eastern side of Somerset. It's very, very unusual in the West Country because it's actually a mining, coal mining area. I mean, most people are not aware at all that Somerset used to be a coal mining area. And this estate, the Ammerdown estate, was, I mean, basically all the wealth for the estate came from coal mining. But the guy who inherited the estate basically had his heart in absolutely the right place. He was interested in ecological issues, he was interested in social issues. He basically turned all his housing on the whole estate into a housing association and got a committee of tenants to manage it. So he literally sold off all the housing into a separate housing association. He started farming all his land organically. He built a study centre next to his house in some of the old buildings there. And I persuaded him to get me to do a study of his whole estate from what we would now call a sustainability point of view. I actually called it at the time Rural Resources and Community Self-Reliance, because the word sustainability didn't, I mean, nobody was using it then, so we had to find sort of more convoluted ways of describing what we now just put under the umbrella of sustainability. That's one thing I still have got a copy of at home, and I occasionally dig it out and look at it, and that really was quite a pioneering thing, because it's doing all the kind of things that are happening now, but, you know, this was back in 1979, 1980. So we were examining how the villages on this estate could be economically, socially and environmentally self-sustaining, how you could develop a kind of the right kind of economy in a rural area, how the land and organic agriculture would contribute to that, how you could generate energy locally and distribute it locally. So we looked at all the renewable energy resources available all around the estate and you know, did quite detailed calculations of how they could be used. At the end of the study, we presented it in three of the village halls around the estate. I mean, the end goal was to hand it over to the people in that locality. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to go back there and see how much of it was put into practice, but I suspect some of it was. Okay, so after that, I went and lived in Cyprus for 5 years. Lived in a remote village on the far western tip of the island. And, you know, it was the old idea. We were going to just do up this old house and be self-sufficient and grow our own vegetables and everything. Didn't really work out like that. It was a fantastic time, but still had to earn money in the end. And it was from there that I went to CAT. Now, CAT, I mean, some people would consider it an eco-village, some people wouldn't. It's got some of the characteristics of an eco-village, but of course it's a very different animal. It was originally set up as a community. I mean, most people think of it now as being a, you know, an all-singing, all-dancing visitor centre and education centre and so on. But the original idea was for it to be a community of people living together communally and living within the resources that they had available. And there were quite a lot of people around in the early 70s thinking about doing something like that, but not many people got round to actually doing it. And this is where the second character in this story comes in, whose name is Gerard Morgan Grenville. And he was actually the founder of CAT. It was his idea in the first place. He did all the groundwork, found the land, found the people, and set it up. And very few people realise that now. Very few people have ever heard of him. He's actually one of these rather extraordinary characters that I think you only find in this country for some reason or another. Probably partly to do with the class structure. I mean, he actually comes from the aristocracy. I think he's sort of related vaguely by marriage to the Marlboroughs and the Churchills and all that. So that's his background. He went to Eton and he did his stint in the army and all this sort of thing. So, you know, he's like sort of classic upper-class English character, but he had this very, a lot of people would say, perverse radical streak to him as well. And he was always thinking up crazy ideas, getting them set up, and then as soon as they were set up and seemed to be running by themselves, he left and thought up something else and got on with that. And he's been doing that for the whole of his life, and he's in his, he must be about 80 now, and he's still doing it. He's still coming up with new ideas. But anyway, when I first went to work in CAT, he was still the chair of the trustees. So although he'd left the place to run itself by itself, because it was a registered charity, it had to have this board of trustees. And he and a group of his buddies, who were all these sort of upper-class toffs, had set themselves up as the trustees of CAT. And when I arrived there in 1988, which is 15 years after it was set up, they were still there as the trustees. But they never came to visit the place at all. They summoned the director of CAT to a club in London to explain what was going on, and in particular to go through the accounts in great detail, just in case the trustees were going to be liable for some horrible financial misfortune. So, as you can imagine, my first impression of him was not very favourable at all. And basically what I did was to look at this situation and decide that it was completely unsustainable in every sense of the word. And I wrote to him and the rest of the trustees and said I thought it was in the best interests of the place and its future if they stepped down from their roles and allowed us to form another body of trustees. And I really didn't expect them to do it, but they did, very graciously, and I was extremely grateful for them doing that. So basically, Gerard Morgan Grenville sort of disappeared off my radar for several years, and then I think it was about 1994, he appeared at CAT and said he wanted to talk to me about a new idea that he'd got. Met him and had a chat to him. And his great new idea was, to put it in a nutshell, to mainstream the idea of eco-villages. In other words, he felt that there were some fantastic things about the whole concept of eco-villages, but that it was, to some extent, in his view, hamstrung by the fact that the majority of people involved in eco-villages had no money, no resources. They had to start very small. They tended to grow very slowly. And there were all sorts of bits and pieces missing from the sort of grand picture as a result. And he felt that this had to be sort of taken up a few rungs and approached in many ways from the same perspective that any other kind of physical development, any new village, new town, new housing development was approached. In other words, in a 100% professional way, but without compromising any of the ideals of the concept of an eco-village. And I sort of listened to him. And I mean, obviously by then I'd been at CAC for 5 or 6 years, and I was really engrossed in what we were doing there and not particularly interested in anything else. And I listened to him, and after he'd gone away, I thought about it and thought, oh, you know, not really interested in this at all. It's, you know, what we're doing here is far more important. But being the sort of person he was, he didn't give up. So he kept phoning me up and writing to me and saying had I thought about it, and he'd got more ideas about it and he was developing them. But he wanted people like me, he said, to work with him to develop it further. And I think perhaps the turning point for me was that he said, well, the conclusion I've come to is that this isn't going to happen in the UK. It's just impossible. There's this combination of ridiculous land values, ridiculous planning laws, terrible bureaucracy. Everything militates against the idea of developing something like this in the UK. So we've got to look at somewhere else in Europe and at least set up a prototype there. And if it works somewhere else in Europe, we can eventually bring it back here when the environment is more favourable. Fine. So he said, well, what I'd like you to do is to come with me for 3 weeks, I think it was, to Spain. I've made some contact with various government officials there, and they've identified some sites that might be suitable for a big eco-village development. So why don't you come and have a look at them? And basically, I couldn't turn down the offer of a free 3 weeks touring around Spain, looking at abandoned villages and sites. So I went with him, and we did look at some amazing places. They were mostly in the north of Spain, in Navarra, mostly in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And a lot of them were complete villages that had been abandoned because the government forestry department had decided they wanted to reforest the area. So they just basically told the villagers they had to move out. Sorry, you've got to go. So they moved them all out, and then in several cases they decided they weren't going to reforest them after all. So they'd gone to all this trouble of moving everybody out, but the villagers were still sitting there. And I mean, some of them were just amazing. But the government departments we were dealing with over there weren't moving themselves quickly enough for Gerard. So he began to lose patience with them. And because he was living in France at that time, he decided to try the French government instead. And this is the sort of person he is. You know, he doesn't sort of go and... Well, he does go and talk to, you know, people who are setting up communities on the ground and so on. But he also just goes and marches into, you know, the President of France's office and says, you've got to do eco-village developments. And he did that, and they were very interested in the idea. And I mean, it pointed out to me one of the huge differences between here and a country like France, which, you know, has the same population but in more than double the land area. And basically, one of the big problems they had there was rural depopulation. Huge areas of countryside where people were just moving out en masse and leaving villages with just a handful of very elderly people. The French government were very concerned about this, and they wanted to find a way of reversing that trend. But being the French government, they wanted to approach it from a very highly analytical, statistical and very economics-based point of view. They looked at what Gerard was proposing and said, this is fine. We'll find some sites for you. We'll pay for a feasibility study. But what you've got to do is to come back with a study that proves that something like this is going to work, not just from a community point of view, but from an economic point of view. And you've actually got to provide us with detailed spreadsheets showing us for at least the first 3 years of the existence of this development exactly how much money is going to come in, how much money is going to go out, how it's going to be spent, what the cash flow is, where you're going to get the money from, so on and so forth. There we thought, okay, fine, why not, let's give it a try. So we went and looked at a variety of different sites, first of all down in Provence, which is beautiful, of course. And we did see some very interesting sites, but all of them had something that was slightly odd about them. I'm trying to remember what the odd things about them were. One of them was certainly an ex-military base, and somewhere on the edge there were still bunkers with nuclear missiles in them, something like that. And another one was a beautiful bit of land, right on the edge of a big lake, but it had a very high-voltage power line cutting right across the middle of the site. So, you know, we were looking at one site after another and saying, yeah, this is good, but it doesn't really seem to work. Government in France is fairly decentralised, so this was with provincial government officials down in Provence, and they were a bit miffed at the fact that all these sites they'd turned up for us. We didn't think any of them were particularly suitable. But anyway, we went back to the central government people and they passed us on to their counterparts in a neighbouring region called Lozère, which very few people have ever heard of. It's one of these wonderful hidden bits of France that has almost no tourism in it at all. But if you go there, I mean, it's just amazing. It's a fantastic landscape. It's actually right on the southern edge of the Massif Central. So it's very high, and it's just before the land basically slopes down towards the Mediterranean. And that southern part of the Massif Central is basically a limestone plateau. It's a bit like around here, actually. So you've got this very porous limestone structure. All the rainwater drains straight through it. You don't get any rivers up on the plateau. The rainwater cuts through it and then carves over millions of years these amazing gorges, like the Cheddar Gorge, exactly the same thing. So you've got this incredible contrast between this fairly bleak landscape on the top with no running water up there at all, and then these deep gorges with incredible fast-flowing rivers along the bottom and very steeply terraced growing land on either side of the river. So we went and looked at a few sites in this area, and eventually we were shown one that seemed to click. Everything seemed to be fitting together. It was one big piece of land, about 850 hectares, which is a hell of a lot of land, that's about 2,000 acres, all owned by one man, which helps, because a lot of the other land we looked at was owned by dozens of different people. And he had actually just put it on the open market. He wanted to sell it. Now, it was one of these sort of typically French stories in a way. He was running these 850 hectares of land as a wild boar hunting reserve. So, I mean, basically the landscape up there is open. There are no fences. There are no land boundaries. It's mostly sheep farming country, and the sheep just roam everywhere. But obviously, if he was going to keep wild boar, he had to fence to keep the wild boar in, and to keep people out as well. So he actually built this, must have been about a 3 metre high, chain link fence around 850 hectares of land, if you can imagine. So anyway, we talked to him and told him what we were proposing, and he said fine. We told him we had to do this feasibility study, which the French government were paying for, and it was going to take quite a lot of time, at least a year, maybe 18 months. And he said, fine, go ahead, just keep me in touch with what's going on. So that's what we did. We spent 18 months doing the feasibility study. It was one hell of a lot of work, and I'll go through a bit of it a bit later on. And at the end of it, we had to put it all together. We had to have the whole thing. It was about 200 pages, translated into French, with all the diagrams and everything else. And then we had to give a presentation of it to serried ranks of government officials in the regional government offices. That was pretty grueling. I had to do a lot of brushing up on French to be able to do that. And it went fine, actually. I mean, we didn't hear for a couple of weeks afterwards, but eventually the French government people came back to us and said, yeah, we think this is good. Go ahead. And we'll work with you to actually realise this development. So we thought, fantastic, you know, all these years of work finally coming to fruition. So we trotted back down to the land, knocked on the farmhouse door, found the owner and said, everything's okay now. You know, we've been given the go-ahead. And he said, oh, actually, I've decided not to sell the land after all. He said, I did offer it to my son originally to carry on the business, and he wasn't interested, but he's come back now and said, yeah, I think I'll take it on. So that was it. That was the end of the whole project. So, you know, we'd produced, I don't know, a couple of dozen copies of this feasibility study. It was obviously quite expensive to produce them, but because we had contacts with the French Eco-Villages network as a whole, I just sent a message out saying, you know, if anybody else is interested in taking what we've done and making use of it to start up a development somewhere else, just we'll send you a copy of it. Quite a few people did write in, and I kept sending out copies and sending out copies. And at some point, relatively recently, I discovered that I hadn't got a copy of the feasibility study left. So what I'm going to talk to you about now, about the actual feasibility study, is largely from memory. And I'm sorry, it would be nice to be able to sort of distribute copies of, or at least give you an electronic copy of the feasibility study. Unfortunately, it was done just at that time when it wasn't quite, you know, there weren't PDFs and you couldn't upload stuff onto the web at that time, so not possible. I don't have a copy of it, and I've been trying to find someone that's got a copy. In fact, a week ago I phoned up Gerard Morgan Grenville thinking he must have a copy of it, surely. And he looked around and said, no, he hasn't got a copy of it either. I've got most of the text in English, and I've got most of the diagrams and pictures, so it would be possible to put it together again into a document. But, I mean, these are all just in individual files. The end product, of course, was desktop published. It wasn't just a simple Word document. So it would need a fair amount of work to put it back together again. Anyway, there's a third character I have to introduce to you as well, a guy called Richard St. George that some of you may know, particularly if you're in the Bristol area. He runs the Schumacher Society. He did work at CAT for a few years, but long before I went there. But I got to know him during my time at CAT. It was just one of those chance things. I don't quite know how it happened, but I was down in Bristol for some reason and stayed with him overnight, and we got talking about eco-villages. And it turned out that he'd been doing quite a lot of thinking about eco-villages, and particularly about the kind of minimum or optimum size for eco-villages, which is something that, you know, everybody's been discussing and churning over for years and decades and everything. So I had a really good evening talking to him about this. I guess we must have been in the early stages of this French project. This was obviously one of the key questions. How big is it going to be? What's the ultimate population going to be? I mean, of course, you can't just sort of go and look it up and say, well, what's the best size for an eco-village? I don't know, 50? 5,000? I don't know. But Richard St. George reckoned that somewhere around 1,000 was probably about right. People. Yeah. Yeah, so about 300 households, let's say. Again, I haven't got all the sort of arguments of how he reached that figure, but there were a couple of things that stuck in my mind, particularly, and one which we carried through and tried to work out in our feasibility study, which was that it needed to be big enough so that teenagers had enough to keep themselves amused and occupied while they were there, and allowing for the fact that inevitably they were going to want to go away and travel the world or do something, whatever, because everybody does, that they would eventually want to come back to it, so that there was enough there for people, both while they were teenagers and when they'd got over that teenage thing and were young adults and felt that this was a good kind of place to settle. And it was also, to an extent, concerned with schooling as well. He felt very strongly that it needed to be able to support at least a primary level school. And this is where it gets very interesting, because as a result of that, I went away and did a bit of research into general UK planning guidelines. Because I thought, well, let's have a look and see what the planners say about the population you need to support a school. Would anybody like to guess what population they think is needed to support a primary school? You think it would be about 1,000?
More.
50,000, they reckon. It's the minimum population to support a primary school. Mm. I don't know how they work that out. Anyway, so we beg to differ with them on that one. Yeah, it is. I mean, secondary schools are another thing. Of course, you can have small schools, like the small school in Devon. And there are all sorts of pros and cons about it. You know, there are all sorts of arguments that when kids get to a certain age, it's good for them to mix with a lot of people who are from different social, racial, whatever backgrounds. I tend to agree with that, but not everybody does. So I wouldn't have pushed the idea that an eco-village needed to have secondary schooling within its boundaries. I mean, of course, there are a lot of debates around this whole issue of how self-contained do you want an eco-village to be? How self-contained do people in it want to be? How does it... If it's an eco-village which is significantly different in all sorts of ways from the mainstream of rural society, in this case, because we were talking about rural areas, how much do you want to separate it off? How much interaction do you want to have with mainstream society outside this fence, running around 850 hectares of land? So those are the kind of issues we needed to look at. But at the same time, you know, the French government people were pushing us to be able to prove that this 850 hectares of land with the fence around it was going to be economically sustainable in its own right, that it wasn't going to need subsidy from the state, it wasn't going to be a drain on the existing communities in the area, because that wasn't what they were interested in, was bringing more money into rural areas. So we finally settled for this number of around about 1,000 people and started looking at the land and started planning it on the ground. And basically there was one old farmhouse on the land. There was another newer house next to it where the existing owner lived. And as with all farms, there was a range of outbuildings all around, most of which were pretty derelict. And amazing architecture in that part of France, because basically it had been completely deforested in the 18th century. Before that, it had been dense forest up on top of this limestone plateau. During the 18th century, when the value of wool was going up and up and up, they basically completely deforested it and put it over to sheep grazing. And that's what it largely is, even now. But because sheep farming isn't very lucrative anymore, the number of sheep farmers is declining, and basically a lot of the landscape's reverting back through its natural progression to forestry. So this 850 hectares of land was partly just fairly barren pasture land and partly regenerating woodland. In fact, the majority of it, I think, we classified as regenerating woodland. And it was actually a rather beautiful landscape, because obviously where natural regeneration takes place, it's not in sort of huge blocks like commercial forestry. You tended to get a pattern of areas of trees with clearings in between. And then at one end of the site was this group of old farm buildings. So what seemed absolutely logical to us in terms of developing an eco-village was to create a village centre around those existing farm buildings, and then to have a series of communities of housing dotted around in these clearings in the woodland, and all of them linked together by a network of paths that were only for pedestrians, cyclists and people on horses. So the way the sort of master plan of the site worked was that there was an area on one edge of the site where motorised vehicles could be parked close to the village centre, so deliveries could be brought into the village centre, people could offload stuff there, and then all the routes from there out to the housing settlements were non-vehicular. So you had hand carts, you had bicycle trailers, rickshaws, horses and carts, whatever. And that the housing developments would essentially, well, we thought there needed to be as much variety as possible. So there'd be smaller ones, bigger ones, there'd be some that were self-built co-ops, there would be some that would be co-housing schemes, some that there might be people who sort of invested all their money together and actually got a contractor in to build their eco-houses for them. We felt it was very important that there wasn't just one single model that everybody had to adhere to, but that there were just certain fundamental principles, which were, first and most importantly, that the land was all owned in common, that no individual could own a piece of land within the development. And then that essentially there was a whole series of guidelines that you had to follow in relation to what you built and how you used the land. So that was the sort of the basic pattern of it. The village centre, groups of housing, and then again on one edge of the site close to the road that went down one side of it, a small scale industrial development. We reckoned that a lot of people would be working from home or from workshops in the village centre, but we felt that if it was going to be economically viable in the long run, then some businesses had to grow and start to employ more than just one or two people. And we did some very interesting work looking at the kind of businesses that might be sustainable or possible to maintain in a remote rural area. Obviously, starting from the use of the land itself. And we got in some French organic agricultural consultants to do a very, very detailed study of the land. And they produced for us a plan of exactly what could be done with that land. And to satisfy the French government, they did these incredibly detailed financial analyses of how many sheep there were going to be, you know, what the value of the wool, the meat, the other byproducts was going to be, how many people it would employ, and then looking at the forestry as a separate industry and the possibilities for horticulture as well. One of the most fascinating things that came out of that whole study, remember, 850 hectares, 2,000 acres of land, admittedly very low quality land, detailed economic study of how best it could be used. So every bit of land was going to be used in one way or another. How many people do you think that would employ full time? Two. That was the end of their analysis. Two people to farm 850 hectares of land, including the forestry operations, the agriculture and forestry, yeah. One of the interesting add-ons that we discovered as far as agriculture and horticulture was concerned was that right at the north end of the site, remember, as I said, this is a predominantly sheep farming area, and what they mainly use the sheep for is milk. It's the centre of the Roquefort cheese country. And right, I mean, literally within 100 yards of the north end of this 850 hectares of land was the Roquefort factory. which was, you know, a huge factory sitting in the middle of nowhere, churning out tons of Roquefort cheese every year. And of course, cheese making involves a lot of water and produces a lot of effluent, which is very high in biological matter. And what they were doing with the effluent, they basically just drilled a hole down into this porous limestone structure, and they were just emptying it down there. So eventually, I mean, to be fair, you know, limestone is one of the best filtering materials you can possibly get. So, I mean, the water was finding its way into the river at the bottom eventually, but there was no contamination of the river whatsoever. But it was still a horrendous waste of water. They were bringing in water to process the cheese and then just chucking it down a hole in the ground. So what we designed, along with the agricultural consultants, was that just inside the boundary at that north end of the site, which very conveniently sloped downhill from the Roquefort factory, we'd have a series of reed bed treatment plants, and then a fairly large horticultural area. So we irrigated all that land with the effluent from the cheese factory. But it was obvious very early on that the land itself was not going to provide an income for 1,000 people living there. So we had to start looking at the kind of other things that people might make a living from. And I mean, they're all the usual lists of things you find in the Eco-Village handbooks and books about communities and so on, all the crafts and the alternative medicine and, you know, running cafes and teaching and everything else. But we thought we needed to look at, maybe look ahead a few years and think, what are the kind of industries that might come together in a few years' time? Remember, this was back in, whenever it was, well, it was certainly over 10 years ago now. And one of the models we looked at was a business that had spun off from CAT 15, 20 years ago called ABBA Instruments, which in itself spun off from Dillis Engineering, that you've probably heard about, the renewable energy company. A couple of the engineers there had decided they wanted to develop a particular bit of electronic instrumentation. It's one of the, you know, only very high-level electronics engineers could possibly dream up something like this. It's apparently for measuring the real-time density of organisms in liquids, which apparently it was impossible to do then. In other words, if you wanted to know the density of organisms in a liquid, you had to take samples and then you had to go away and test them, and that might take 3 or 4 days. And, you know, by then the process had changed and things had moved on. So what they'd designed was this instrument that you could just put into a liquid and the dial told you exactly what the density of organisms was. They thought this was going to be of tremendous use in the water supply industry, particularly in third world countries, for determining water quality and so on. So they developed it, they marketed it. It got to a point where they set themselves up as an independent business. The irony of it actually is that their main customer now, 15, 20 years on, is the alcohol industry. Because they are one industry that really does want to know. I mean, it's all about yeast. Yeah. They need to know exactly what the proportion of yeast bodies is.
Of course.
And this instrument just did exactly what they wanted. What that set us thinking about was, that's exactly the kind of business, actually, that could just as well have been located in the depths of rural France. Mm. Because it was essentially about brain work.
Yeah.
All the people employed there were employed thinking and designing things and making instruments, but they only made about 3 or 4 of these instruments a year, and they were only this big. So, you know, there weren't environmental impacts to transporting goods here, there and everywhere. It was really straightforward. So we did quite a detailed case study of that and several other similar businesses that essentially were using mostly brain power rather than materials and could do a lot of their operations on the internet. Now again, you know, the internet of course has just gone boom since. So the possibilities now are far better than they were when we were thinking about it. But it was just an example of how we were trying to sort of get ourselves out of the rut of traditional eco-village thinking there, which said, okay, everybody's got to be making crafts. If you're going to make a settlement of 1,000 people economically sustainable, then you've got to think a little bit beyond that. And then the third element of the economy of this village, as you can probably imagine, was ecotourism. I mean, it was perfectly placed for that. So we included in our feasibility study a development of what we called an eco-gîte. Now, I mean, there are thousands of gîtes that people market as being green gîte one way or another, but there weren't at that time. And I think it could have been quite profitable. I think that is basically the story. I mean, I've told you about how we went about the feasibility study and it all fell apart at the end because the guy didn't want to sell his land. And I've told you a little bit about, you know, how we actually went about doing this feasibility study. This was Gerard's idea, and he had tried it over here in a few places and got absolutely nowhere. So his feeling was that it had to be done first of all somewhere else in Europe, and that eventually it would find its way back here. Now, a few years ago, I know he was in negotiation with Powys County Council. Powys. It was actually in a stone quarry. Not a slate quarry this time, but I'm not sure what stone it was, actually. I'm not sure why that didn't develop, actually. Because I think in that instance, the Powys Planning Department were actually quite supportive. But, I mean, one of the big, big issues over here is land values. I mean, almost any other country in Europe, apart from the Netherlands, possibly, you'll find. It was partly because of the difference in planning laws, and partly in the difference in the government attitude towards different forms of housing provision in France that made it so much easier for us there. Yeah. In our trying to disentangle how the process by which a development of this size could happen, we recognised that there had to be a core of people who are fully committed to it in the first place and who might possibly later on withdraw from it altogether.
Yeah, sure.
But had the vision and the commitment to get the thing moving in the first place and to act as stewards for the ideals that had to be put into place. I think this is one of the most interesting aspects of it altogether, you know, because you look at existing villages anywhere in the world, basically, and they have grown up organically as a result almost always of certain economic considerations to do with the land and how people can make a living out of the land, and that brings people together in one place, and then they need other skills that bring other people in and so on. Whereas now everything is planned top down. So any kind of new housing development, any kind of new town has nothing actually to do with the land or what the land suggests to you. It's simply a matter of saying we need X number of housing units. And, oh, yes, if we're going to have X number of people here, we'd better build a school, we'd better build some industrial units and so on. And the really interesting question is there any way of finding something in between those two?
Sure.
Yeah.
that allows communities to develop organically.
Yeah.
But at a reasonable pace, so it's not 1,000 years before it reaches its fruition.
Yeah.
Obviously, we did a fairly good analysis of the global eco-villages movement as part of the feasibility study. And Crystal Waters is one of the ones, and the farm in Tennessee. Those are examples of... I mean, the farm in Tennessee had a population of 1,000 at one point. It's declined down to a few hundred now, but it seems to be something that affects eco-communities of all shapes and sizes. I mean, a few years ago, I went to the European Eco-Villages Network meeting in Italy, and we did a tour around a number of eco-villages there. Some of them were newly starting eco-villages, and they were fantastic farmers. There were loads of people there with fantastic energy, and they were building houses and doing things all over the place. And we went to some other communities that had been there for 20, 30 years, and they were fantastic places. I mean, you felt they were just sort of a dream. You would just sort of love to go and live there. But all the young people had moved out of them. The population, age of the population was going up and up and up, and they were just dying on their feet.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of you know the Machynlleth and the surrounding area there, but You know, I mean, that's a fairly remote rural area, but there are an awful lot of brain-based businesses around there. There are a lot of people that have consciously decided they want to go and live there and do intellect-based activity. I do think, though, in the end, it's always going to be a very small minority. There are two aspects to it. One was the, if you like, the business of agriculture. So it was looking at the land and saying, okay, let's forget about, in a sense, the fact that there's an eco-community here, but just analyse the land and determine what the value that can be got out of it is, and what the employment is. But when we were designing the housing developments, each housing development was basically had its own horticultural area attached to it. So the assumption was that each housing development would be self-sustaining in terms of at least of fruit and vegetables.
Okay, sure.
There are examples of eco-communities that have been built in various places in the UK, but they go through this inevitable cycle. People either self-build or get built for them a house, which initially they manage to build quite economically. You know, the land values are fairly low and they do a lot of the work themselves and so on. They make it into something beautiful, and then of course they decide they want to move on, so they put it on the market, and suddenly it's valued at over £1 million,
yeah.
and only
the rich.
But it's very difficult because of course we never put this into practice, so we're you know, this is just based on what we the other thing that came out to me most strongly from our investigation of other eco-villages was the weakness of the economic side of the sustainability triangle. In other words, you know, the triangle is environment, society and economy. And generally speaking, everybody involved in eco-villages pays a lot of attention to the environmental and social aspects of it. But because we all grew up, and I count myself among this, thinking economics is a dirty word, and we shouldn't really bother about money, I think that's been one of the great downfalls. Society and environment. So I think it's, if something like this was to develop, it would be really important that there's, that the economic analysis of how it's going to function is given as much importance as the other aspects of it. I would have said that one of the basic principles of an eco-village is that it has to live as far as possible within the limits of the resources. That will determine to some extent the size of it. I mean, it comes, in a way, it just comes back to this same argument: what is the optimum size? If you've got an expanding business and an eco-village that clearly hasn't reached its optimal size, then that's great. If you've got an expanding business in one that has reached its optimal size, then the issue really is, do you expand physically, do you buy up the neighbouring land, or do you spin off another similar development? Maybe 5 miles away, 10 miles away, or whatever. In this kind of field, we tend to think small all the time. I mean, have any of you ever really sat down and thought about, now what would an eco-city of 1 million people be like? We don't really think like that. But why not?
It's not
me. I mean, the Chinese actually are doing it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think they've got about 4. I mean, obviously, you have to go into the detail of it and determine whether it can be genuinely called an eco-city, but they have set out to build what they consider to be 3 or 4 eco-cities with populations of 1 million plus.
What about...
Yes.
I probably got one of the last copies of your...
mistranslated the number.
On that point, yes.
And I think if anyone wants to have a little chat, Roger will be here for a little while, and he'll be over with us at the Eco Village store, which is over there. And thank you all very much for coming. And thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Roger. Yeah.